I'm Peter Mudlin, and you are listening to Teacher's Lounge. And if this is your first time hearing our show, I've got great news for you. It's based on a really simple idea that we've all had teachers in our lives who helped us become who we are today. And every educator we have on this podcast, whether a classroom teacher, a coach, or professor, is nominated by the folks who listen. We want you to be a part of this show with us. Please tell us about the educators who've inspired you and the folks in your community who deserve a spotlight. You can email us with your nominations and your story ideas at teachersloungenIU.edu. And on our show today is Jared Ploeger. He wears a lot of fascinating different hats in education. First and foremost, he is a social studies teacher at Bolingbrook High School, but he's also the president of his local teachers union, and he's a member of the District 308 school board in Oswego, so he's also an elected official. And so on top of his day-to-day work in the classroom, he's also in leadership positions at two of the 10 biggest school districts in the state of Illinois. It is a lot, and Jared thankfully takes the time to really break down what his union work looks like, how he advocates for his fellow teachers and for state legislation that might be able to help them, and we really go behind the scenes of what it's like working on a school board at a large district, the responsibility of being transparent and having a real open relationship with the public, especially at a time when school board meetings have been very contentious at times over the past few years. We also talk about how much he misses coaching middle school basketball and what got him interested in pursuing a career in education in the first place. We go into all of that and so much more, but first, we have an education story we want to share. This fall, Northern Illinois University announced it would be closing its Laredo Taft Field campus in Ogle County. And I got to spend a day in the woods with one of the last NIU classes studying there. Students in NIU's nature writing class sit in a circle in a bright clearing just beyond the forest.
Well, just looking for something that stands out to you. You can explain it before you read it, or you can just read.
English instructor Molly McNett guides her students. One of them is reluctant to share, but does anyway.
If I lie long enough, I can see the ripples of wind waving beyond the canopy of leaves, calling me home.
The students, some of whom are English majors and some who study environmental science, just hiked out from a classroom at the field campus, exploring the woods and listening.
I think it's a class in paying attention more than anything else, but we also study writing, and we study these particular things that are in the books that we're reading too, but a lot of it is about paying attention to the natural world.
This is the only 4-credit course that's been held at the outdoor campus in nearly 2 decades. It's only been offered since 2022, and since it's a special topics course, it doesn't run every semester either. But for the students who have come to Oregon and experienced Laredo Taft, the woods and the views of the Rock River, it leaves a mark on them.
Just being in nature unlocks a part of your, like, writing muse that you just don't know you have until you do it.
That's Nicholas Regelbruggy. He's an English major in the class, and the field campus was originally an artist colony back in the early 20th century after an artist group discovered it at the Chicago World's Fair, and Regelbruggy says he feels that creative spirit alive and well in the forest surrounding the campus. He's only been to Taft a few times, but he was devastated to find out that it was closing.
It's honestly a travesty. This is a valuable class, and if I could, I would have it offered every semester of every year.
In a statement announcing its decision, NIU's Rena Kachonis described Taft as a picturesque facility in dire need of maintenance and repairs too costly to take on. For the past 25 years, it's mainly housed camps for kids, which she said has, quote, minimal alignment with NIU's current mission and goals. Shannon Forney is the special events facilitator at Laredo Taft, and she says aside from the camps, they also host many NIU groups, and there's another academic program that uses it too.
The PE majors. They come for a weekend in February and they learn how to do all of our classes. And then a few weeks later, they come back and they actually teach our classes.
NIU's statement said that a majority of Laredo Taft staff will be able to stay on with the university, but Forney's not sure if she wants to stay.
This is home. This is home for a lot of people.
She says not all of the staff received offers they were happy with.
The thing that got me is the transfers weren't necessarily like equitable, but the ones that really, our education staff really got the short end of the stick. There was nothing for them. Especially the ones that have been here for 10 years. There was no offer, or it was, oh, by the way, I guess we can put you here.
A statement from NIU said the universities worked hard to identify and offer opportunities to eligible staff. In the final weeks, Forney's hosting family reunions for old staff and students to come back one more time. They're also hosting some of their last camps.
We do like a goodbye song for when the kids have their last meal with us. And I don't know how we made it through that song. It was really hard.
There's also an online petition to save the site by handing operations over to the State Department of Natural Resources. Back at Taft, a small group of McNett students makes a whistle out of an acorn cap, while others scribble down notes as they head towards a fallen log.
You can't do this in a classroom because we're in the subject matter. We're in the field.
NIU's closing the campus at the end of the year. But for now, the nature writing students are still walking the woods, learning and paying attention. I'm Peter Medlin. All right, now it is time for my conversation with social studies teacher, union president, and school board member Jared Ploger. We start off talking about just how busy he really is.
And I said to her at one point, I said, is it really like this every summer? And she was like, no, it's just one of those summers. And I'm, man, no, not even in the summer do I get, does it seem like a break? For a couple weeks, for a few weeks. But I can tell you, it felt like school started this year on July 28th. July 28th, I was receiving messages from people saying, we need to talk about the morale of the schools. And I'm like, well, it hasn't even started yet.
You're like, it seems pretty quiet, actually, from my perspective.
Yes.
Well, I'm glad that it's at least just one of those summers and not an every summer thing, because it seems like, especially over the last 5 years or so, that in a lot of areas of education, people have said that, like, every year kind of feels like just one of those years. So hopefully that's not the case with this particular issue.
Yeah, I hope so. It's interesting, though, because the nice thing about the school board is, like, it really does kind of mirror the school year. Like, there's stuff that we're doing and people are like, whatever, I'm not paying attention to that. And then, bam, you know. So it is fascinating.
Yeah, how is the school year going for you, classroom wise?
I love my job. I really do. When I became, the president of the union, I had like a Mandela effect. A lot of my fellow teachers were like, "Oh, he took the gig, so he doesn't have to teach." And I'm like, "No, I still teach. I only have half the day release for union stuff, and I love it. I don't know how I would be able to do all this stuff without the refreshing voices of my students. It is just, I'm very blessed. I realize that every day.
Yeah, I didn't know that you were union president now. So what is that scale? What does that schedule look like for you then?
Yeah, I always say I accumulate thankless jobs. That's what I do in life.
Maybe one of them will be, you'll be thanked for, I hope.
Yeah. No, that's not totally true either, because there are a lot of people that I come across that are very thankful. And so, but at the same time, like, I do these things and people are like, I don't know if I would want to do that, and I'm like, okay. So I teach periods 1, 2, and 3, and then technically, like, I have a plan period 4. That's my time to plan. And then the rest of the day is, dedicated to dealing with the other side of a different district, right? So I'm the, seventh largest school district, sixth or seventh largest school district. I serve on the school board. And then I think we're down to ninth largest school district. I serve as the union president. So it's interesting. I see this from so many angles.
Oh, and I definitely wanted to talk about that with you too. I didn't realize that you had stepped up into that leadership position with the union too. I think that people are maybe a little bit more familiar with the work of school board, week in and week out. But when it comes to being a union president, especially at the local level, can you talk about some of the things that, like, what does that work actually look like on a day-to-day basis for you then?
It's a lot of people who come to you for help. In some cases, it's a lot of people in tragically in very desperate situations. I mean, I think part of the problem we're having collectively really is that there are a lot of people dealing with a lot of things, right? Some of that is classroom. Some of that is not, you know, there are health things going on. Some of it, quite frankly, is, you know, how we treat each other, you know, and that is like something people don't always want to talk about, right? You know, those outside of education many times will think we're some kind of monolith, you know, group, if you will, that, you know, moves in unison. And it's like, well, you know, it's education. That wouldn't make sense if you're inside education. So many of the debates that we have, and sometimes it's dealing with people who really, you know, and they're passionate for a reason, right? You know, I've done all this research and this is a positive, this, that, and the other. And then, you know, you feel almost like a dream breaker sometimes because you're like, okay, let's look at the system as a whole and realize that if this gives, then this other piece, right? Do we want to do that? You know, like in my district, a big thing that they're talking about right now is we have these two early release days. It's a burden on many of my peers who have families. And so it's a lot of research on other school districts and how they're kind of doing professional development and PLCs and department meetings and building meetings and how do they all work those things in. And it's difficult because you see another district and you're like, oh, this looks really good. And it's like, okay, but they also do X, Y, and Z. Do you want that? And it's like, well, I don't want that. And it's like trying to get them to piece all of that together, the entire picture, is many times a challenge.
Well, and it's interesting that you have that broad perspective from the union and from the school board now. And you've been, you know, a part of that work for a long time, right? Like you've been on school boards for going back past decade or so, right?
Yeah, so I was first elected in 2015. And then in 2019, I did not rerun. My wife had a brain tumor. She had what's known as an acoustic neuroma. So she lost her left ear. I mean, this part's still here, but the inside of her ear is gone. And my wife is also a Spanish teacher as well. And we didn't realize that, you know, these get big enough. They push on a part of your brain that really does hinder some of your cognitive abilities. And so we thought this was like the new reality. She really struggled that first year back. She probably should have taken a year off. I had to step away from the board for sure. Yeah, I stayed, you know, involved indirectly with what was going on in with our schools. I knew a lot of what was going on. The good news was that was temporary. We learned that that's usually a year to recover from that. And sure enough,
she's doing all right now.
She was, yeah. And so then COVID hit, right? And then we had two school board members, one left who moved to Arizona, and another one, after receiving threats, she decided to leave the board. And so that second one was the one I came back on. Ooh, was that 2020 or 2021? So I came back and then I won in 2023, and then I'll be done in 2025. I've decided not to run again at this point. I really am tired.
and, <yeah. laughs> all those thankless jobs catching up a little bit, huh?
A little bit at this point, yeah, I am. And but at the same time too, I think there does need to be a balance on a school board. It's not an argument for me to leave. I'll be honest with you. I think school boards need new people, but they also need that historical context. And honestly, like I'm the longest serving school board member up there. And when I leave, if the other people who are with me also leave, you know, we'll have three school board members with a combined experience of 6 years. And if they bring in four new people, that's it. You'll have seven people with a combined experience of 6 years. So I'm torn because I feel like, ooh, maybe this isn't the best time to leave. So that historical context is still given. But at the same time, you know, I am tired.
Well, that's funny that you mentioned that, because that's like almost a broader conversation about like political term limits that I'm sure that you have like actually in your social studies classes. I actually remember last year or 2 years ago, because we're part of the Illinois News Broadcasting Association, and we had at one of our meetings, we had Sherry Bustos there to have a conversation, U.S. Representative Sherry Bustos, who I believe is now, didn't run for re-election, is now, I think she also got tired and was like, I think I'm done. We had this broad conversation with her about the idea of term limits in politics, right? Because she's like, I've been doing this for 10 years. I feel like I'm better than I ever have been in some ways because I have that institutional knowledge. I understand how the system works. But so like, where is the sweet spot between, you know, having that time to understand the system and get better at it, but then also not overstay your welcome is always an interesting balance, and even at the local level.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, I admit I grew up in a small town, so the concept of term limits, believe it or not, I kind of cringe at, only because, you know, in my hometown, they've got to go out and find people to volunteer for stuff like this. Like, sometimes they can't fill positions.
You grew up in Salmon, so, right?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
I grew up in Sandwich. I saw that.
Yeah. You know, we could have a long conversation about some past things on Sandwich school boards.
Lord.
But yes. But that's the danger of local politics, and I don't think people see it as much, is because we don't pay attention to it, there is, and you know, you talk about like conversations people don't want to have, there are definitely people who know people are not paying attention, and they realize that they can get away with a lot of things, and that's scary to me and sad at the same time. And for me, I'm glad you bring up this topic, because for me, I kind of look at it as, okay, this is the time to walk away. And if I can't relinquish willingly, you know, a leadership position and find other ways to lead, then, you know, what am I doing? And I don't like to use the word power, but nonetheless, it is a position of power, right? And if you can't leave those positions of power willingly and find other people, I mean, we're a large place. It's, you know, in my school district, you're talking about tens of thousands of people, and we only find 7 people to really do this. And of course, I always hear people say, oh, well, I don't have time. And well, great. Allow me to introduce you to my wife, and she'll tell you all the time I have. Right. You know, and that's the other piece that plays into this, you know, and I always say I wish people would go. I would approach things with more questions and fewer claims, because I think they would get that experience quicker. And I think there would be people self doing this, you know, as far as term limits and so forth are, is called. That's the ideal world. You know, I know we don't always live in the ideal world.
Sure. Yeah. Well, yeah, definitely not. But like, it's always interesting from my perspective, since, you know, I'm an education reporter and I cover the entire like northern part of the state and even into Wisconsin a little bit. So I'm kind of keeping tabs on a lot of different school districts, and you see some, like, especially large ones, where you see that there's a lot of, you know, public statements. There's a lot of people that come to those meetings to express their thoughts and opinions on issues. And it's interesting to see that it's some of those districts that are about the same size, that some of them, you know, every single month or, you know, every single meeting, there's a line of 6 to 10 people that are there to give public comment and, you know, express, you know, issues going on. And then some of them, they're really huge school board meetings, and then seemingly there's no one giving public comment. There's no one there. And it's an interesting thing to, like, how can you even as a school board, like, cultivate a community that wants to be a part of that? And like, hopefully in an ideal world, you want that to be like mostly civil, but otherwise just like engagement period is a good thing. And it's interesting about even like how much as a board you can even really do to encourage that.
Yeah. I don't know whether it's good or bad, but when I went out door to door last time, there were many people who came to the door and they said, oh, I know you, you're the Facebook guy. Yeah. You've got my vote. And I don't know that I want to be known as Facebook guy.
That's not a good thing. I think in your case, it's probably a little better.
Yeah, right. Only because they said afterwards, you've got my vote. but it was a difficult election, because like, I'm sitting here wanting, all right, I know what I want to talk about. I want to talk about, you know, how we've made advancements with transparency and how we're working on our communication. And I want to talk about, you know, how we're climbing our way out of the financial, situation we put ourselves in. And it was so polarizing because one piece or one group came in that it was literally like I was going to doors and people would say, wait a minute, are you that group? And I would say, no, that's not me. Okay, I'm going to vote for you. And like that shouldn't be the case either. Like an election should be a dialogue, right? And I look at, like, to your point, like there are communities where the board is having dialogue with the community. And guess what? Sometimes that's uncomfortable. Sometimes that's difficult. Sometimes there's going to be hurt feelings. But there are communities where there's no dialogue. And that to me is like disturbing. It is the largest portion of your property taxes. You should be kind of figuring out what's going on, right? These are our kids, our future. Like, people should have questions. People should have debates. Those are all healthy things. And like, I know there are many communities, including the one I serve as a teacher, where it is very much clear that silence and marching on is the better way to go than having some of these uncomfortable conversations. And that doesn't help the kids. It really doesn't. And even though I've had sleepless nights in Oswego when it comes to being a school board member, I'll take that. My community being involved. And sometimes, yeah, are people in the community? Do people in the community take things and distort them? 100% that happens. But I look at it as, okay, they don't know how to form these questions, and that's why they're going there. I'd love to sit down and have conversations with people. As long as they're not, and we've had this, as long as they're not political operatives coming from the outside, which was wild to deal with.
Did you guys have to deal with those like hate groups coming in to your meetings?
Ours is interesting. You know, we've had a couple like outside, like they're really like political operatives who were trying to go. Yeah, those groups came in, of course, and they were definitely, you know, either, I don't want to say they were working in coordination because, you know, I'm not a big conspiracy theorist, but they definitely had like-minded people. And we certainly had, like, you know, what was it, Project 1776, certainly got involved in that school board race. I feel like if they were better coordinated, they would have done a better job. And that's a little scary to me. But now, you know, you've got a few who have, you know, kind of given up on this area and moved west. And some of the stories now that I'm hearing back home where we grew up are quite alarming. You know, there was a person in Plano who had a sign up and, you know, political sign. And you know, they're throwing it out there on social media, supposedly asking for people to throw moving boxes onto their lawn. I mean, really, like, stuff that, you know, I don't understand. It's foreign to me. I love debates. And so some of these communities that are not having them, I think they're seeing other things come out because they're not having the conversations. They're not having the dialogue.
Right. So I'm curious. So again, like, you've been doing this school board wise since like 2015 or so. Now, obviously, with, you know, some time in between then. But, you know, you've had a lot of experience from that, you know, broader perspective. How much do you think that has changed your work in the classroom day to day?
Quite a bit. First of all, it's weird because, you know, technically I'm an elected official, right? So I'll tell students sometimes, hey, this, that, or the other. And sometimes they'll have questions and it's nice to get that local concept. As a social studies teacher, every single election I run. And so I would tell my students, there's not an election every 4 years. There's not an election every 2 years. There's at least one election every year. And being able to give them some of that background on the local stuff. I've had fellow educators that are like, they're never going to learn this. Kids don't care, this, that, and the other. And I'm like, well, we don't make efforts to get them involved, you know? And I think part of it, if we're being honest, is many of us are coming from our own lens of gaps in our own education. You know, I mean, when I was in school, I think we did a mock election for the president. That was it. We never did a mock election for a governor or a state senator or the mayor even, right? And in many cases, like, I remember trying to do that in my own school on a local level, and people were afraid. They were like, ooh, be careful on the local stuff, you know? And I'm like, 80% of the people aren't even going to vote. How is this dangerous? And now I had a student who told me something that I will never forget. And he raised his hand and he said, Mr. Ploeger, I think the reason why adults don't vote in these elections is because they don't understand. They don't get it. And he went on to say, I think we actually might have more information than many of them do. And that was a hard voice to ignore because I think he was right. And that's hard for us collectively as adults to say, but I think he might have a point. Like just the fact that they were taking time to look at it, they were experienced. And of course, you know, whenever we bring up the concept of maybe like expanding the vote to younger people, the first thing that people say is, oh, they'll just vote how their parents do. And I'm like, well, in a local election, then that means 80% of them aren't going to show up. So, yeah, it's fun to have those conversations, though, because it really is like holding up a mirror. And, and you don't want people to take them personal. It's an attempt to have that dialogue, like I say.
Yeah, it's something I think about from my own school experience that, like, I don't think I knew until I was an adult how school boards function, really what they did. And I think about it now where I think that there's a growing amount of school districts that are making active, like, good faith efforts to include student voice more. And, like, a lot of them have, you know, student school board members or, like, kind of an advisory council of students. Even, like, I hope that they're engaging, like, middle school. I hope they're engaging elementaries. Like, get as many as we can. And it's interesting because, like, I could think of, you know, for example, like, in DeKalb, like, pretty big school district where, you know, they have a student school board member they've had for the last couple years they've been doing it. And, like, last year, a group of students pushed to, like, change the, you know, school food vendor and, like, were able to, like, get a big change like that. Like, that is incredibly empowering. I, like, hope more students are getting more of a taste of, like, again, like, A, how things work, but, like, B, having an impact on the local level. Like, what's more, you know, what is more kitchen table than literally what you're having for lunch and breakfast at school every day, right?
Yeah, never underestimate the art of breaking bread with someone. Yeah. Yeah, Oswego's been kind of at the forefront with that. So it's been, we've had two now up there for the last 4 years. This was kind of cool this year. We actually, like, had them, like, do, like a swearing in kind of ceremony, which was awesome. We're trying to give them as much of that experience as possible. And I feel like every year their voice does become more, more involved. It becomes louder, which is great. I like it also because there are many times as an educator on a school board, it's like, so tell us, you know, what's really kind of going on. Give us that, you know, concept. And like, I can give you a teacher's voice, right? But it is very rewarding. It is very crucial to have that student voice piece as well. And watching myself and the students that are up there and the adults kind of, you know, tackle this whole cell phone piece as an example is fascinating to watch. It's a great dialogue. And it's something that I think is awesome. In the district where I teach, it's fascinating. There was a board member who I know who really was pushing hard for it, for the same concept. And it was wild to me that there were board members who weren't so sure about it. And again, I think that dialogue piece matters. And I think they were worried they were just going to show up and say, oh, I don't, let's put a pop machine somewhere or whatever. And it education has changed so much. The students really, they get it. They really do understand, okay, this is the role I'm in and this is what I signed up for and I'm ready to go. You know, they really do want to do things that probably when I was their age, you know, even myself, you know, I felt like I was pretty connected to what was going on politically. I mean, they're way above where I was.
Right. And then you also have the union work going on in the person who nominated you, Colleen, who's also been on the show, one of your coworkers, that she mentioned that, you know, one of the things that you particularly do with the union is being involved, particularly on the legislative front. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Oh, so I, when I first, you know, kind of took a position with the union president then said, oh, I have the perfect job for you. And I said, oh, well, what's that? And she's like, you would be great as our legislative chair. And I said, okay. And, you know, I did have some experience, obviously, with legislation, because being a member of a school board, you get all these things, you know, sometimes weekly when session is going on, telling you about all these bills that are out there, and you really learn a lot about the process. I'm no expert on the process, and it is amazing, like, how much is out there. It really is. It's a large task, right? And so I got involved with that piece, and now I'm the co-chair for the 14th district for AFL-CIO as well. And there's just, the system really is very large. It is very interesting approaching the system, if you will. You know, whether it be things like when to fill out a witness slip, when you can't anymore, you know, how to even keep track that a witness slip is available, and what does that even mean, you know? And for those that don't know, you can have your voice heard during these committee processes by filling out a witness slip. You know, you're either for or against something. And
so we've talked about, you know, a little bit about classroom teaching, but a lot about the school board, a lot about your union work. One of the other jobs that you had, another hat that you wore on top of that, is that you were a coach for a long time. Are you still coaching?
I wish. No. Yeah. If you go to Jane Addams Middle School gym, you will see my name in the gym. This is a true story. I've had students before who've said, wait a minute, I saw your name in this gym. And I was like, yeah, in another life, right? I coached basketball for probably 12, 13 years, somewhere around there. And we had a lot of success. It was a lot of fun. I've had a few players go pro.
Really?
You know, one here in the States. And I know another one who plays overseas professionally. Lots of D1 players that I've had the honor to coach at the middle school level. You know, it's been great. It was great. But I also coached Scholastic Bowl.
That's right.
For a while, I wanted to know. I actually was able to get our Scholastic Bowl team downstate, which people don't realize what a feat that is at the middle school level, because there are so many large school districts where they basically have like feeder programs. Like you have like, hey, if you go to Rockford and you are you know, in gifted program, you're going to go to this school,
right?
Or Springfield, these magnet schools, like a lot of these large public middle school or districts that have large or a large middle school population, they have like magnet schools. They're just not officially called that. And so I'm actually kind of very proud that we were able to get that team down there. And for a while, I was like, oh, you know, I wonder what, there's an exclusive club of people who've gotten their Scholastic Bowl team and their basketball team downstate. But it's probably just a club I made up in my head, but it was a lot of fun and I hated it. I actually, the end of last year, I was going to coach Scholastic Bowl again at the high school level. I did that for a year. And I told you earlier on about how my summer went and I had to walk away and I felt bad. Luckily the person that took my spot, he's awesome and he'll do a great job, but I wanted to, it still calls to me. It's such fun. But I had to walk away.
Well, now that you might be finishing up with the school board, you know, maybe the coaching return could be, you know, maybe.
We'll see. You know, it's funny you say that. We were at sectionals one time for Scholastic Bowl and I literally had to duck out because there was like a major issue and I'm like, I'm not going to be able to make it. I've got, you know, it's sectional, it's Scholastic Bowl. And so they texted me and said, okay, jump on. And, I jumped on, cast the vote. I forgot what it was about. And then I remember saying, okay, do you still need me? And they're like, no. And I'm like, okay. And then I ran back in to coach. Yeah. So maybe, I wouldn't have that problem, I guess.
How, between coaching Scholastic Bowl and basketball, are there a lot of similarities between coaching both of those things?
I think in the realm of identifying the talent, you know, identifying, I don't want to say they're all talented, but identifying what their strengths are and how they translate, 100%. However, there's one major difference. And I remember when I was first really kind of building our Scholastic Bowl team, we got destroyed by this one of the schools in our district. And there's a slaughter rule, right? If you reach 300 and I think it's 301, game automatically ends, right? And so afterwards, yeah, the coach says, well, you know how it is. Like they really wanted to reach the slaughter rule. And I'm thinking, yeah, but we're coaches. I really wanted to play as many people as possible, but okay. And he's like, well, you know how it is with basketball. And I'm like, there's not. I remember one time we won a game in basketball, and I think it was like 68-2. And I wasn't even, they weren't even trying. Like, we were like, it was like, don't come out past the 3-point line. All this, there's no slaughter rule that ends the game in basketball, but in basketball, there is.
No, so
there's definitely some differences.
Yeah, that's wild. It's, I mean, basketball coaching, particularly, is there anything that you think about now where there's like some of your favorite things about coaching that sport? Particularly,
oh gosh, it's like so many stories. I can think of this. The first one that comes to my mind is my son's in the other room. There was one time where I literally like split my pants, and he had to run and go grab go grab my extra pair of pants. He's laughing about that one. But
are you pacing back and forth on the sideline? Is that how it happened? You're just getting too into the game?
Yeah, it's interesting. My students at the time, they're like, oh my gosh, like you're a different person when you're coaching. And I was like, yeah, it really was. You know, I got into it because I wanted the kids to know, like, hey, I care. I'm here with you. Particular thing that I miss, I think the strategy was so much fun. You know, you knew that, like, in middle school, all these kids have flaws, right? But they also have, like, you know, a lot of talent. And I think that's the piece I miss most, is working with, like my fellow coach or some of the players. And I'm like, let's see if we can do this. Let's see if this will work, you know? And like a classroom, you know, you're like, oh, let's see if this works. I think this might work for them. And I miss that so much because, you know, I think when you're young and somebody does something like that and they're like, hey, this person's really listening. They saw what my strength was. And, you know, I got to utilize those to the, you know, degree that I can. And I think that's what I miss most, the strategy piece and getting them involved and really being able to accentuate strengths. I miss that a lot.
Yeah, and that's something that we talk about a lot in the context of sports, is like coaching to, like you said, emphasize your players' strengths and not underline or highlight their weaknesses. And that's not something that we talk about as much when it comes to, you know, just being a classroom teacher, being a social studies teacher, but it's, I'm sure, the same thing in regards, right? Like, you are trying to emphasize and highlight what your students' strengths are too.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I had a student the other day, like I have this Padlet, and I had a student the other day, and they're like, hey, can you organize this like differently? Cause it's, you know, I'm struggling with this. And I'm like, you know, it was like how the stuff was presented or the order. And I said, yeah, that's an easy fix. And then of course, you know, I do it and I ask the class, is this okay? And they're like, oh yeah, that makes more sense. And I'm like, okay, cool. Again, when students feel like they have a voice, I think it really, it really matters. And it's not necessarily about, you know, I've taught AP classes, I've taught co-taught classes. When I was in middle school, I had this thing called 21 Voices, where they took really like some of our students who really were dealing with some of the biggest things. So I've taught an array of students over the years and coached an array of students, and it's not necessarily like one of my favorite stories from coaching wasn't even our most successful team. I knew they weren't, I knew what their ceiling was. But you know, we weren't supposed to win the first game. And I said, oh, we're going to do this, that, and the other. And I think this will work for us. We practiced and it worked. And I think that's the fun of everything, right? Is like, you want people to hear you, anyone does. And then for someone to see you and be able to get the best out of the talents that you have, I mean, that's so rewarding.
So you've been a classroom teacher for almost 20 years at this point, pretty close?
Yeah, I think that I'm pretty sure this is my 19th year in the district I teach in. Yeah, it's either my 18th or 19th. I get confused because I student taught in the same district. So it's either 18 or 19 that I'm working on.
Because I know that for a lot of teachers, when you're first starting, right, like you're so focused on just, do I have the content down? Do I have that so I can actually teach it? And then over the course of your career, I'm sure you evolve a lot as an educator. Can you talk about again, just over the course of your career, some of the big areas that you feel like you have evolved as an educator?
Yeah, the content was never a problem for
good.
Me.
It's a good thing.
True story, right? Like, I had two older brothers, and when I was like 5 years old, you know, my oldest brother expected me to understand the complexities of NATO. You know, so like I'm five and I'm like, what is this? You know, you always have like this proverbial story of, you know, your brother, you got older brothers, they take you out in the backyard and they toughen you up. That's how my brother toughened me up. It's like, you better come with the ability to navigate through this stuff. So the content's never been an issue with me. It was interesting. It was funny because last year I was elected by the students as the best storyteller or the person with the most stories or something like that. And I really think the content really lends itself to that because there's so many connections you can make. As far as how I evolved, much more like I really try and instill in my students now, as opposed to when I very first started teaching, that we have to figure out how to communicate, right? And so, you know, I understand that I have, you know, introverts and people who don't want to work in groups and so forth, but the collaborative piece is just so big in my classroom at this point. And it's what I try and push all the time, because quite frankly, like, we go back to the political discussion we had earlier, and part of the problem is that we don't see each other all the time. And so I think it's imperative that these young people understand how to see each other. And so that's definitely something that I don't see that going away, but, you know, maybe I'm wrong. The technology piece for sure. I'd be lost without technology. And technology, when I first started teaching, was, you know, how good is your PowerPoint? You know, and it's like, oh, good grief. You know, and I remember like that first year was like survival mode. And I'm like, oh, this has got to be something more beyond this.
Were you an overhead projector teacher at that point? Do you guys have that?
Yeah, we got away from that. I did have like a it's computer.
Good to hear.
So it did have PowerPoint. Yeah, but I came in, so this is a true story. So the Jane Addams, where I student taught, they called me in mid-October and they're like, hey, can you take this job? And I said, I can, but it was a halftime gig. And I was like, but I need to give my job 2 weeks notice so that they know what's going on. The principal then called me back like 3 days later and said, oh, I'm sorry, but it's not going to happen. And I'm like, okay. So I went ahead and tell my job, never mind. And then they came back and they're like, can you start tomorrow? And I'm like, no, because I need to like be able to tell my job, you know, give them 2 weeks of notice of what I'm doing. And what I was doing just to teach that first year, I was working in the north side of Aurora at a company that monitored parolees and sex offenders in the state of Illinois. So I'd be there from 7 to 11 and I'd drive all the way down to Bolingbrook, teach the last half of the day there. And then drive back and work I'd get back usually about 5 o'clock, 4 or 5, and then I'd work till 9 o'clock at night. So that's what I was doing just to teach that first year. And I came in and the students were very difficult on a teacher who left, and that was what was going on. And so a lot of it was just survival mode. But I really liked those students. I really did. And I think that made the difference.
So speaking of early in your career, I wanted to get into a little teacher origin story. Is teaching something that you were interested in since you were a really young kid having to recite Article 5 of NATO with your brother, or was it something that came to you a little bit later on in life?
You know, the irony of that piece is my oldest brother, he did not get along with teachers at all. In fact, when I ran for the school board, my oldest brother, this is a true story, I laugh, and really the family laughs. It sounds terrible, but he sat me down and he said, let me explain why I wouldn't vote for you. And it was all because I was a teacher. It was all because
I guess that's helpful, the Oppo research, you know? That's nice.
100%. And to his point, there were definitely people who did not want to vote for me because I was a teacher. So it did help, but it was just comical. But my mom, I give all the credit to my mom. My mom was the first person in her family to receive a college education. And you're talking early 1960s, which, you know, You know, I'm trying not to get too sentimental about this because my mom, you know, she unfortunately has a lot of dementia now, and it's just so sad because she was the most educated person in the family for so long. And I really did have like these two sides to me, right? My mom was the educator. She was the very educated person. And my dad was he was blue collar. You know, I don't know this to be true, but I don't think he made it out of Sandwich High School with his diploma. It's kind of one of those things where we don't talk about it. He ended up going into the military, you know, truck driver, blue collar kind of guy. My mom was the educated one. And I had these very contrasting examples. And so when I first got out of high school, you know, I went to college. I did great my first year. And then I struggled. And so I left for a while and you know, worked with my dad for my dad. And I was like, no, this isn't really what I want to do. I was in a band at the time. That was a lot of fun.
What were you playing? What instrument?
I was a singer and I played a little guitar. Yeah.
Singer guitar. Love it. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a band called Just Dinner. Back in the day.
Not a bad name.
No. I mean, we had a good following around the, you know, Sandwich, Caneland, DeKalb area back in the day, but that was a long time ago. But, yeah, my mom was definitely, I got to hear all these stories. When my mom would lose a student, I saw, when my mom would talk about students that she was trying to help, I would see that, it's where I understood that there were a number of probably peers that I had who were dealing with things unimaginable to me at home. And so those were the pieces where it was like, I want those people to have advocates. I want those people to have somebody who they could just kind of take a sigh of relief around. And that was the influence for me. My mom taught for about 25, 30 years, somewhere around there. She took most of the 70s off because she had my brother and I. But the impact that she had on me is incredible. The other thing that I will say that geared me towards teaching, and I would be amiss if I didn't mention this, was I remember when I was in fifth grade, and I remember Melissa Ackerman. And the fact that someone would harm a kid is still, I still don't understand it. And I didn't understand it there. And I don't understand it now. And I don't think it's something to understand. And to be able to be there for kids and know that, you know, they might not like you all the time. They might not connect with you. Those things happen. But to know that there's a safe adult in their life is that means a lot.
When do you remember when you told your mom that you like wanted to pursue teaching?
I think she was excited.
Was she surprised or no?
No, she wasn't surprised at all. She kind of thought that this was something I probably should have just done from the beginning. But you know, like she'll say that or think that maybe, but I think I kind of needed to walk in the shoes of others, if you will, for a while. You know, I needed that time right out of high school. I don't think I would have been as good of a teacher if I had gone to college 4 years, graduated, and gone into the classroom. There's a number of stories that helped me to connect with my students.
Yeah. I don't have too much more for you, Jared. I really appreciate taking all this time out of it.
Yeah, appreciate you.
I wanted to ask you, we talked a little bit about like how you feel like you've evolved as a teacher and that sort of thing. And I had one more about that. You know, I saw a video that I think your district put out on like their YouTube channel a couple years ago that was of you teaching, when you were still teaching middle school, you were teaching your students about Ferdinand Magellan and kind of the, you know, the expedition to circumnavigate the Earth. And one of the questions you ask students is actually something that I ask people all the time as a journalist. Mm. And so I wanted to pose it to you. You asked your students, like, how do you measure success? And you were talking about it, obviously, within the context of Magellan, right? Like, are you successful just because you made it around the globe? What if you, you know, what was the goal? What if you lost people along the way? That sort of thing. But I ask people all the time about, you know, how they measure success, whether it be like some piece of legislation or initiative or program or whatever it might be, right? But for you, you know, as, you know, you go along in the classroom and over the years, has how you measure success and how you think about success in the classroom with your students, has that changed a lot over the years?
I mean, yeah, there are things that have changed as far as like the curriculum and, you know, how well I write, success criteria, all those things. But at the end of the day, are my students safe? Have they increased their knowledge? Have they left? Are they able to come into my classroom and feel like this is a place where I can, you know, I can learn? Are my students in a better place because they came into my classroom? Like all of those things, you know, those are the success pieces. The one thing I think that has changed, because now I've been teaching for so long, is what are the voices of my former students, right? What do they think? And, you know, I don't want to go into like, oh, well, you know, I've got this, that, or the other, because we hate that. If we're being honest as educators, we don't like it when somebody's like, well, I had this happen. Yeah, I know we don't, right? But I will say that I have the knowledge, I at least have the knowledge to know there are a number of students who are doing a number of just fantastic things. And because they've reached out to tell me that they're doing those fantastic things, that means so much. You know, I had to bury both my brothers in the last 3 years, and the amount of former students who reached out, like, to me, that's like success, you know, like that means so much. I think there are teachers out there who teach better than I do. I know there are. I think there's teachers out there who know the curriculum better than I ever will. And I know that. And I think sometimes, though, as teachers, we forget that we're a team, and we want these students to come across an array and a diverse group of educators. And the one thing that, you know, I will say is I truly believe that my students feel like they're listened to and they're heard, and they feel safe. And to me, that means the world. And I think that's successful. I'm not saying I'm a terrible teacher either. I'd like to think I'm not. But I see my peers and I know the great things that they do. And we all kind of have our talents, going back to that other piece about coaching, right? What are the talents that I can accentuate?
Right. Last question I always like to finish with.
Yeah.
What's something about being a teacher that you just wish more people knew?
I wish people understood what you take home. I had one time, my former boss, they're like, oh, well, come on, you get summers off, so it must be nice, right? I'm like, okay, I'm not gonna sit here and tell lies. Usually July is most of the time, although this last summer not so much, but most of the time it is very, you know, I'm not as stressed, but like during the school year, like we're constantly busy, and there's things that we're doing besides just being in a classroom for our students. I've got a student who wants me to come to the football game next week for a band. I've got another student who asked me to come watch her play volleyball in a league she's in. I've got another student who plays football at Northern Illinois University. I went and saw them. I had a student a few years back who was like, oh, I really want you to come to my senior night at Iowa State. I was there. And it takes like a lot of time away from your family. I'm happy to do those things. It means the world. Right. But I've also had situations where students have come up to me and they're like, hey, so you're my trusted adult. And then, you know, you've got to go get them help, and they'll stay with you. And they add to the, they add to those sleepless nights. And I'm not saying that every teacher everywhere is perfect. I had my own run-ins with teachers when I was a student. But overall, I see the vast majority of my peers who just, they take this stuff in and it's hard. It's not easy.
All right. Well, that was all I had for you. Thank you so much again for taking the time. I'm sure we could talk another hour or so.
Yeah, probably, right? Yeah.
All right, that was my conversation with Jared Ploger. He is a high school social studies teacher at Bolingbrook High School, a local teachers union president, and he is on the District 308 school board in Oswego. As always, thank you so much for listening to Teacher's Lounge. Feel free to nominate a teacher in your life to be on the show. It's how we get all of our great guests like Jared. You can send them our way to teacherslounge@niu.edu. And wherever you're hearing this podcast, subscribe, leave us a rating, and share so we can get even more perspectives on the show. You can also subscribe to our Teacher's Lounge newsletter to keep you up to date with everything we've got going on with the show. A big thank you to the Northern Illinois band Kind Devs for the music you hear each and every episode of the show. And I have been your host, Peter Medlin, and we'll be back with even more Teacher's Lounge very soon. See ya.